But first to a sudden crisis that has erupted and stunned most observers, so that effectively Sri Lanka is a country without a prime minister. On the 26th of October, that country's president suspended parliament and fired the prime minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, and cabinet, installing former strongman Mahinda Rajapaksa. Now, there have been two motions of no confidence passed against Mr. Rajapaksa and his chosen cabinet ministers, and Sri Lanka's Supreme Court has also overturned the president's decision to dissolve parliament and to hold elections on January the 5th. You might have seen the unedifying spectacle last week in the country's parliament too. Politicians shouting, throwing chairs, water bottles and chili powder at each other, and the House Speaker, Kuru Jayasuriya. Where is this heading? This country that, remember, only recently emerged from one of the truly awful civil wars of our time, and of course is also a place well visited by Australians. Well, I'm pleased to be joined now by Professor Damien Kingsbury, a personal chair and Professor of International Politics from Deakin University. Welcome to the program, Damien.
Good to be with you.
How do we understand this? I mean, do they have a functioning parliament at the moment?
Well, the short answer is no, although they do have a surfeit of prime ministers, not a lack of.
Right.
Yeah, so there's two
a caretaker government there at the moment, strictly speaking.
Well, technically not even that, in a way, because the government, which was supposedly sacked a couple of weeks ago, claims that it's still the government. The prime minister claims he's still the prime minister. And the new prime minister also claims that he's the prime minister, despite two no-confidence motions against him. And, of course, the president's now been put out in the cold all by himself.
So in a sense, look, we're watching a lot of things, but is the whole Westminster system as we understand it, because I've been trying to thread my way through it, and it does your head in trying to understand it, is it still operating? Is it up for grabs in this, you know, the way we do democracy, which they've rather prided themselves on, haven't they?
Yes, they have in the past, and I think that really is the critical question. Sri Lanka does have a history, despite the way in which parliamentary democracy has operated in that country, which has been somewhat to the exclusion of ethnic minorities. The parliamentary democracy has otherwise been quite successful, but this really is testing it. It's really asking questions about whether the country can continue with a parliamentary democracy or whether it's going to move towards some other model. Now, over the past 8-10 years, the constitution's changed a number of times. So the role of the prime minister and the role of the president has changed. And the president, who's currently in a more symbolic position, has in the past assumed executive powers. It's quite possible that should there be a change in the presidency, there would be a change to executive powers. It could be that the one of the two current prime ministers, Mahinda Rajapaksa, would again like to be an executive president. So it's really unclear at this stage how this is going to resolve and whether or not the country will continue with a parliamentary democracy as we've understood it.
So the election on January the 5th will be a real election, will it? And I mean, have we got any idea how people are going to vote in the middle of this?
Well, at this stage, we don't even know if there's going to be an election because the Supreme Court has essentially put it on hold for the time being. It won't make a decision on that, on whether there will or not be election until the 7th of December. So things are still very much up in the air. If there is an election on the 5th of January, look, it's possible that the party that's being led by Mahinda Rajapaksa could win a majority. Certainly, as a populist political leader, he does command a great deal of support. But having said that, he's not able at this stage to command a majority in the parliament. So it's a very, as they say, a very fluid situation and one in which the range of possible outcomes is quite varied.
I mean, we have a surfeit of prime ministers too, one could say.
But in succession.
Well, that just shows you about the importance of institutions. People do leave the parliament or they get out of the building. And people, you know, a lot of people must be looking on with concern, like the US and China and India. And I gather foreign aid has been stalled. $1.5 billion IMF program has been stalled in the midst of all this. So there's really a great deal at stake, isn't there?
There is indeed. Look, I think just to go back a step, one of the things about democracy, parliamentary democracy, is that it's played according to what's referred to as broadly the rules of the game. Once you start chucking the rules out, then it becomes it becomes untenable, essentially. And that's what appears to have happened now. But in terms of Sri Lanka's economy, in terms of its aid program, its foreign relations, I mean, that's really the critical issue, because the IMF is saying, well, we don't know who we're dealing with. We don't know who the government is. The bureaucracy is stalled. Relations between two major powers in Sri Lanka, India and China, are up for grabs. And I think at base, that's probably the most critical aspect of this issue, is that the two contending prime ministers broadly represent the competing camps around Chinese influence in Sri Lanka and Indian influence, and how that plays out will have very important implications for strategic relations in our part of the world.
Is that really what you say is at base here, in a sense, if one's trying to understand it and put some sort of structure around it, that it's those competing views around India and China?
Well, that's certainly the key distinctions between the key rivals for the prime ministership. I'm not suggesting that that's what the fallout is about or the dispute is about. I think it's really simply about a power grab by Mahinda Rajapaksa. He does have a strong sense of himself as being a glorified leader, that he has deserved his place in history and should reclaim it as a consequence of defeating the Tamil Tigers 9 years ago, and he wants to be back in power. He's never really gotten over having lost the what was then the executive presidency, and he certainly wants that position back, or a position very much like it. But in the background, there are the competing positions about support for China versus support for India, both of which have complex relations with Sri Lanka. China funded the government of the time in its defeat of the Tamil Tigers, supplied weapons to it. India in the past has actually invaded Sri Lanka during the war with the Tamil Tigers in order to stop a humanitarian catastrophe. It's a complex relationship. And, of course, India and China are the two regional superpowers which are competing with each other and which are vying to shape the future of not just this part of the world, but the world more broadly.
Yes, we're going to be discussing that later in our foreign affair. That's a very prominent sort of takeout from the APEC summit. So we've got this amazing personalisation of politics too, by the sound of you, Damien.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is personalised. We are seeing the parties coalescing around figures, not around policies so much. There's no, apart from the issue of China and India, there's no fundamental difference between the positions of the parties or of the respective prime ministers. It is very much about personality politics, and the way they're jumping between parties at the moment does remind one a little of Papua New Guinea, where it's very much less a question of party policy or party loyalty, and very much more a case of who can do a deal for a particular candidate and where are they most likely to meet their aspirations.
So what has this done to confidence in Sri Lanka's economy, which I understand had already dropped to its lowest spot in quite some time?
Yeah, look, the Sri Lankan economy had picked up after the end of the war with the Tamil Tigers. Certainly that war was very destructive and very costly. After that, the economy did pick up to a large extent on the back of very substantial Chinese investment. But what we've seen more recently is not a collapse, but a very much a slowdown in the Sri Lankan economy. But in the past few weeks, the rupee has absolutely collapsed as a currency, and the country is in institutional and economic chaos. So confidence in the value of the currency and in the country's economic future is at a very low ebb at the moment.
Is there any risk that this could spark hostilities again, armed hostilities? I realise the Tamil Tigers have been defeated, and but you know, this must be a brittle sort of mosaic of settlement only 9 years after that shocking civil war.
Yes, absolutely. Look, Sri Lanka has a history of another civil war with between the government and the JVP, People's Liberation Party, back in the 1970s, reprised again in the 1980s. Now, whilst that was a war against communist or allegedly communist insurgents, it did demonstrate that the Sri Lankan body politic is a fragile one, a brittle one, and is prone to fracturing. And the current events, whilst they don't have the ideological or ethnic colouring that either of the two past conflicts have had, it's possible that we could see a split, particularly if the military decides to take sides and determine the outcome of this particular stalemate. And that's quite possible.
Oh, yeah. Well, what is the military's role in all of this?
Well, at the moment, the military is sitting in the background, but it has had or it has played a very strong role in Sri Lankan politics over the past 15, 20 years, particularly as a consequence of the defeat of the Tamil Tigers. And under Rajapaksa, the military was privileged to some extent and was to some extent politicised. So if the military decides to come in and end this political stalemate, which militaries have been known to do in developing countries. They say, look, the civilian...
Well, Thailand being the obvious example.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are many examples. So they could say, look, the civilian government's incapable of organising its affairs. It's in a stalemate. The country's going to hell in a handbasket. We need to step in and sort things out. If they do that, there's certainly a chance that could happen, or alternatively, they could come in behind one of the two competing prime ministerial candidates and support one or the other. But that would imply that there would be no respect for a constitutional process. And that would, if not spell the end of a democratic process in Sri Lanka, at least put it on hold for some considerable time.
My goodness. Well, we'll watch with interest. Thank you very much indeed for that analysis, Damien Kingsbury.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Damien is personal chair and professor of international politics and director of the Masters of International Community Development at Melbourne's Deakin University.